ओम शांति 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 लिसन एंड रिपीट सदाशिवसमारंभां शंकराचार्य मध्यमां शंकराचार्य अस्मराचार्य पर्यन्तां अस्मराचार्य वंदे गुरु परंपरां वंदे गुरु परंपरां
वेरी गुड सो वेलकम बैक वी कंटिन्यू आवर न्यू सेशन ऑफ वेदांत क्लासेस इन व्हिच वी आर गोइंग टू स्टडी सिक्स शॉर्ट टेक्स्ट्स ऑफ श्री शंकराचार्य आई गेव अ वेरी थरो इंट्रोडक्शन इन द प्रायर क्लास इफ अ फ्यू ऑफ यू आर कमिंग फॉर द फर्स्ट टाइम बाई ऑल मीन्स गो टू आवर वेबसाइट एंड लिसन टू दैट ऑडियो इट विल बी क्वाइट इम्पोर्टेंट फॉर यू टू गेट द ओरिएंटेशन फॉर द ऑनगोइंग क्लासेस Also on the website you'll find our text. You should all have the text. None of you should be sitting here empty-handed. You'll want to take notes. You'll want the text in front of you. You can either purchase your own text or on our website you can simply download and print the copy that's there. So please plan on bringing a text to each class. It'll help us stay focused properly for this study. Finally, let me remind you that we will begin each of these classes with a meditation. What we'll do starting next week is we'll give you a few minutes grace period. The class starts at 7:30. We'll give you a few minutes grace period, and then we'll close the doors and ask that no one enter during the meditation because it'll disturb those who are meditating. So if you do come late, then we'll ask you to wait in the lobby until the meditation is over before entering. So starting next week, please make it a point to come on time. All right. Good. And just before we begin, just a very pleasant observation. In most circles, the study of Advaita Vedanta is considered very somehow esoteric and inaccessible and not something that people would commonly be inclined to study. And to see so many of you here for a class on Advaita Vedanta on a Tuesday night is very rewarding. It really shows that you've discovered a value for the profundity of these teachings. You know very well that the vast number of Hindus find very simple sadhana, like going to a temple, saying some simple prayers, sufficient. But what the ancient rishis gave us in the form of the teachings of Advaita Vedanta is so much more. And we know that it's not meant for everyone, but I think it's delightful to see so many of you here for these classes on Thursday nights, on Tuesday nights. I'm sure you'll find them rewarding because the texts we've chosen are extremely profound and important. And as I mentioned in the introduction, the texts are also set up in a progression. So we start off fairly simply, and then quickly, the American English expression is you ramp it up. And that's what we'll be doing as each text continues. We begin with sadhana panchakam. Repeat after me, please. Vedo nityam adhiyatam, vedo nityam adhi, taruditam karma swanushtiyatam, taruditam karma swanushti, tene shasya vidhiyatam, tene shasya vidhi. Apachitik kamye matistyajyatam, apachitik kamye matistyajyatam, papaghah paridhuyatam, papaghah paridhuyatam, bhavasuke doshonu sandhiyatam, bhavasuke doshonu sandhi, atmechavyavasiyatam, Atmechavyavasiyat Nijagrahat Turnam Vinirgam Yatam Nijagrahat Turnam Vinirgam Yatam. The first of the five verses of Sadhana Panchakam. And in these five verses, as we discussed last week, what we find is a sopana, a staircase. It's also called Sopana Panchakam. A staircase meaning a series of steps which define a life of sadhana. But not just a life of sadhana. a life of sadhana that culminates in enlightenment, that is, a stairway that reaches all the way. How frustrating would it be to go climbing up a stairs and it stops halfway before where you want to go? That would not be very helpful. This is a very complete stairway, staircase, steps. It does, in fact, lead all the way to the goal, enlightenment. We began this in the previous class, just the first little bit. Vedaha nityam adhiyatam. The Vedas should be studied every day, all the time. That is, in every day, there should be time set aside for spiritual study. We discussed this. Further, taduritam karma swanushtiyatam. Su anushtiyatam swanushtiyatam. Taduritam karma, the karmas described in the Vedas, taduritam, the karmas described in the Vedas should be swanushtiyatam. They should be practiced. They should be followed. And we discussed in the last class that when we're talking about karmas in the Veda, we're specifically talking about rituals, yajna. So the Vedika yajna, the Vedic rituals described in the Veda, should be followed, should be practiced properly. Now, bear in mind that Sri Shankaracharya was teaching his group of disciples. His group of disciples, we can presume, were mostly brahmanas, in all likelihood. So these brahmanas were required then, certain rituals. So he's giving very basic instruction of living a good, pious life. And that's a basic instruction for all of us. How can you take to a spiritual life if you don't begin with a simple religious life? So simple religious practices are considered then a precursor or preparation for more profound spiritual life. And if you're climbing a staircase, what happens when rungs are missing? You get stuck, right? Then if there's one rung missing, the next rung is too far up, your leg won't reach. So in the same way, we're going to see a series, in fact, we counted in the last class, a series of 38 steps in these five verses. And if you leave any one of them out, what happens? You get stuck. So everyone is meant to be practiced. So we've seen the first two steps here, Vedo Nityam Adhiyatam. Every day there should be some time set aside for spiritual study. Taduritam karma sunishtiyatam. In Shankara's time, brahmanas were supposed to do their rituals. You don't need to do Vedika yajnas. You do, if you want to follow all these steps, and I know you do want to include some kind of appropriate prayer or ritual in your daily routine. The kind of prayer or ritual is up to you. But in the absence of any prayer or ritual in your daily routine, you are skipping a step. And we just discussed the consequences of that. Why is it an important step? Because, and now we'll go on to we covered this much in the last class, we'll continue. You can't skip that step because tena, by doing that, by the performance of taruditam karma, by performance of those rituals and prayers, tena, by that, ishasya, and we have to get the word apachitihi. We have to bring that in. It's in the next line. Ishasya apachitihi vidhiyatam. There, vidhiyatam, there is the establishment of ishasya apachitihi. Ishasya, isha, Lord, Bhagavan. Ishasya, for the Lord. For the Lord what? Apachitihi, worship. Tena, by following those rituals in the Veda, or by following whatever form of prayer or ritual you perform, tena, by that, we perform worship of Ishvara. Now, what's very interesting here is the use of the word apachitihi for worship. It's not a common word for worship. Usually, worship, puja, we use terms like puja for worship. Archana, etc. Apachitihi means worship, but it has a funny negative meaning. If you know Sanskrit a little bit, you know that the root of the word is a negative. Apachi, it means to get rid of an accumulation. What do you mean by worship by getting rid of an accumulation? Very interesting. Significant that Sri Shankaracharya would choose that word. Before we get into the word, please tell me, does Ishvara need our worship? What a silly thing, right? Ishvara doesn't need our worship. So if we choose to worship Ishvara, for whose sake is that worship? It's for our sake. Then, if it's for our sake, how does worshiping Ishvara help us? And I want to correct a common misunderstanding. The conventional wisdom is worshiping Ishvara is like praising your boss. That's conventional wisdom, and I take exception with that 100%. Absolutely not. So by praising your boss will act more kindly upon you, right? That's the conventional wisdom. And then people carry that kind of attitude over into prayer. What a shame. What a shame to drag Ishvara down to the level of your boss, of all people, dragging him down to the level of your boss. This is childish thinking. If you think that praising your boss may work. I won't dispute that. It might work. Praising Ishvara doesn't work like that. Because Ishvara is not like a human being whose feelings can be swayed by your praise. Ishvara is not like your boss. Ishvara doesn't have human emotions. In fact, what your boss does might be conditioned by your praise, but what Ishvara does is conditioned only by, you can actually say that, only by karma. Ishvara is karma pala data, the giver of the fruits of your actions. If you do good things, good karmas, punya karmas, Ishvara will give you good results. If you do papa karmas, Ishvara will give you papa. Will give you undesirable results. Of course, prayer is a punya karma, so you will get good results from your prayer, but it doesn't mean you're going to get it tomorrow or next week or next year. There's no rule. It all unfolds according to the laws of karma. Ishvara, we understand as karma paladatta, the one who gives us the results of our karmas. So it means that we have to look for another meaning for worship. How does worship of Ishvara help us? We know it doesn't help Ishvara. He doesn't need our prayer. He doesn't need our worship. If no one goes into a temple, do you think Bhagavan feels sad and lonely? Right? You get the point. So clearly, it's not for Bhagavan's sake, it's for our sake. But then, if it's for our sake, how does it work? We just dismissed the most common understanding of how prayer works. The most common understanding is that prayer is a form of emotional manipulation, right? Isn't that a right way of putting it? It's like a child buttering up mom so that the child can get his or her way. Or it's like when you praise your boss. It's the same thing. It's emotional manipulation. Emotional manipulation only works with somebody who's available for manipulation. You can manipulate Bhagavan? If your prayers can change Bhagavan's actions, it establishes that you are more powerful than Bhagavan. Huh. So can we admit this is a lot of silly, childish thinking about prayer and worship? And in a class like this, we need to be on a firmer foundation. Prayer and worship helps. How? Helps us. How? And the key is in the word apachitihi. It helps through a process of removal. What are we removing? Well, we could answer that in many ways. In one way, by doing a good karma, we're getting rid of our bad karmas, our papa karmas, through any form of prayer or worship. It's like a prayaschitta karma. You are wearing away any negative karmas you may have. It's also an act of inner purification, because in prayer and worship, you turn your mind away from ordinary worldly things. You turn your mind towards Bhagavan. which is a holy, saintly activity. It helps purify our minds and hearts. These are the ways that prayer helps us. And we know that in a very simple way. We'll move on in just one moment, but one final comment here. People, especially, children and adults both, but especially if they're a little bit more, I don't know how to say, jaded or sarcastic, they'll ask, how can you say prayer works? How do you know prayer works? And the answer is surprisingly simple. If you pray or do a ritual with Shraddha, that's an absolute requirement, with a proper attitude, with a prayerful mood. If you pray or do a ritual, at the conclusion of your prayer or ritual, do you feel better or do you feel worse? There's my proof. That's it. In our ordinary experience, we find that prayer helps us. This is apachittihi. It helps us by removing our problems, by removing obstacles, removing negative karmas, and removing impurities in our minds and hearts. This is apachittihi. This is a worship that takes place through removal or purification. And then the next step, kamye matihi tyajyatam. Tyajyatam. Remember, all of these verbs are these imperative verbs. One should. May it be done is the sense of all these imperative verbs. May it be done. Tyajyatam. May it be given up. Tyajyatam. May it be given up. May what be given up? Kamye matihi. Matihi, an attitude or thinking. Thinking about what? Kamya, what is desirable, what I want, what would make me happy, what would be pleasing. This goes with the prior comment of, or the prior teaching. Tad uditam karma sonushtiyatam. You should do the Vedic rituals. Many of the Vedic rituals are kamya karmas. Many of the Vedic rituals are done for the sake of getting a desirable end. If you're a farmer and you want good crops, you do these rituals. If you need some money, there's this nice Sri Sukta that comes that comes in Yajurveda, so you can worship Goddess Lakshmi. There are rituals for the birth of a son. These are common examples of kamya karma. The commentator makes it very clear that taruditam karma swanushtiyatam excludes kamya karma. He says it's only nitya naimittika prayaschitta karmas. This is a little bit of Vedic information. In the rituals in the Vedas are said to be of four kinds. I might as well see this briefly. Thank you. So the karma, Vedika karma, the Vedic rituals are said to be of four kinds. Nitya karma, again, karma means ritual here, right? So nitya karma means rituals which are to be done nitya, every day. Then there are naimittika. Naimittika karmas, which are karmas to be done on special occasions. You know, for example, there's upakarma, where many men will replace their yajnopavitam. Other rituals done on other, on Makara Sankranti, all of the festivals basically are opportunities for these naimittika karmas, occasional rituals. Daily rituals, occasional or special rituals, naimittika. Then the next category, prayaschitta. And I'll stay with all Roman letters so no one will have a problem. Prayaschitta karmas, they translate in English as expiatory karmas. I think prayaschitta is easier to pronounce than expiatory. Expiation means like paying off a debt. So prayaschitta karmas are karmas done for the sake of removal of prior papa karmas, prayaschitta karmas. So the fourth and last category of Vedic rituals are kamya karmas. Kamya is that which you want, that which you desire. Money, better crops, birth of a son, etc. So all of the rituals in the Veda fall into one of these four categories, but the commentator makes it very clear here that when Shankaracharya says tad uditam karma swanushtiyatam, he's only talking about these three. Why? Because Shankara says a few lines later, kamye matihi give up any thought about performing rituals for the sake of fulfilling your needs. And this really, it's a slap in the face for conventional religious thinking. It really is. Conventional religious thinking means you go to the mandir and you pray, hey Bhagavan, please, and pardon me for being sarcastic, please, something, give me this, give me that, yay dedo, yay bhi dedo, you know, this kind of prayer. And that's a conventional religious attitude. What does Sri Shankaracharya say in the very first half of a verse? Kamye matihi tyajyatam. Give it up. It's not to condemn it. To pray, hey Bhagavan, please give me this, please help me with that. It's not being condemned by Sri Shankaracharya. Sri Shankara, in this text, Sadhana Panchakam, is not teaching the general public. This is not a text meant for the general public. This is a text meant for students of Advaita Vedanta. This is what it is. This is a text meant for students of Advaita Vedanta. So for these students, they are expected to have a more mature religious perspective. And a more mature religious perspective means we don't pray to Bhagavan, give me this, give me that. That's from the standpoint of Sri Shankaracharya, that's considered somewhat childish. Not wrong, but suitable for people who have a more childlike approach to prayer and not suitable for a seeker of enlightenment. Then, pap augaha paridhuyatam. Paridhuyatam. Through all of this, paridhuyatam, you are cleansed. You are cleansed of what? Pap augaha. Oh, that even sounds bad. The papa auga, the collection of papa karmas. Papa auga. You are purified of all papa karmas. Oh, the commentator has just, I won't, yeah, the commentaries go on and on and on and on. So I won't share much of this, but there's one nice observation he makes here. He says, in Sanskrit, it actually sounds funny. Prakshalanat hi pankasya durat asparshanam varam. He says, instead of papaugha paridhuyatam, you are cleansed of your prior papa karmas through prayer, but the commentator observes that prakshalanat hi pankasya, what is better than cleansing oneself of dirt, pankasya prakshalanat varam, what is better than cleansing yourself from dirt is durat asparshanam, keeping the dirt far away and not touching it at all. So the point is, by avoiding papa karmas, then there's less need for the process of purification. That's the point that the commentator makes at this point. Papaugha paridhuyatam. We must become purified of these past papa karmas. Past papa karmas, which would then create obstacle to our spiritual study. All papa karmas create undesirable consequences in the present for us. And one undesirable consequence is not being successful in our study of Advaita Vedanta. Therefore, papaugha paridhuyatam, being cleansed of all karmas, is essential, even from the standpoint of Advaita Vedanta, for the sake of removing any obstacles that could impede one's study of Advaita Vedanta. Then, that would probably conclude the preliminary set of steps. I guess we call that a flight of steps. So we've just come up one flight of steps, we're on a landing, and we're now ready for the next flight of steps, which means a series of steps with a slightly different direction. The first series of steps are definitely preliminary, and in fact they don't apply specifically to Advaita Vedanta, they apply in general to any life of sadhana. But now Advaita sadhana, the spiritual practices specific to Advaita Vedanta, begin here with the next line. And that line is, bhavasukhe doshaha anusandhiyatam. And when I'm breaking the words apart for you, removing the sandhi. Sandhi means the spelling of words change, where two words come together. I'm just undoing those changes so you can see the words more clearly. Bhavasukhe doshaha anusandhiyatam. The dosha, the defects associated with bhavasukha. Bhavasukha, worldly enjoyments. Bhavasukha dosha, the defects and shortcomings of worldly enjoyments, anusandhiyatam, should be reflected upon. Reflect upon the limitations of worldly enjoyment. This is pure Vedanta. Vedanta begins with this observation. We want, and we actually use some of this in the introduction to the text last week, so I'll keep my comment here very short. We discussed last week, we want happiness, contentment, peace, and we want it not just in a little bit at a time, but we want it continually. We live our lives seeking continuous, unbroken contentment and peace, and what we find is, in spite of all of our efforts, we haven't found it yet. As hard as you work in worldly life for unbroken contentment and peace, it hasn't come yet. I know that for a fact, because if you found it, you wouldn't be here. Definitely not. There are so many other things you could be doing on a Tuesday night, so I know, without doubt, it hasn't been found. And about by now, we've all come to recognize it can't be found. Eventually it sinks in that no matter how hard we work in life, we will never, through our efforts, we will never produce a life of perfect contentment, peace, happiness, and joy. This is one of those waking up moments when this discovery is made. This discovery can be made at any age. For some of us, it was made quite young. You know, in my case, I remember in my early 20s getting that message very clearly. No matter how hard I work, no matter how smart I work, I will never gain lasting contentment through no matter how much effort I put in. If you don't get it in your early 20s, you get it in your 30s. If you don't get that message in your 30s, you get it in your 40s. Sooner or later, you get it. This is what experience teaches us. This is what experience teaches a person who is capable of learning. Because we observe there are many people, in fact, most people in the world, continue to suffer failures and frustrations. They continue to make huge efforts. They continue to fail in gaining the contentment and peace that they want. And they keep trying and trying and trying and trying. Nothing wrong in trying. The problem comes with the expectation that one day they will create the perfect life, a life of contentment and peace. That expectation is naive. So here in this line, Shankara points to the dropping of that naive notion that with enough effort and time we can create a perfect life. And instead, he says, anusandhiyatam, reflect on your own experience to understand bhavasukha dosha, the defects, the limitations of what can be accomplished through worldly efforts, what kind of enjoyment we can have in the world. But then, if there's no happiness, if there's no lasting happiness to be found in the world, does it mean we're just doomed to lives of suffering? Like somebody once joked about the Western existentialist philosopher who had this wonderful doctrine. His doctrine was, life is suffering and then you die. It's accurate in a way. In a way it's accurate, but that Western existentialist philosopher missed out on something taught by the ancient rishis and taught here by Shankaracharya, and something that you have all intuited. And that is, the reason we fail to gain happiness through worldly efforts and worldly activities, the reason we fail is that the true source of happiness is not out there. You've all figured this out. The true source of happiness is not out there. It is in here. That's a remarkable discovery. It goes along with the prior one. First, the prior discovery was, I won't find happiness through worldly efforts. But then the flip side of that discovery is, I can find lasting happiness through a spiritual inquiry, through an inward-turned pursuit, which is why Shankaracharya says next, Atma Iccha Vyavasiyatam. Vyavasiyatam, you should decide upon Iccha, a desire for Atma. Atma Iccha, Atmecha. A desire for Atma, which is the true source of contentment, of happiness, of peace, love, and joy. Atmecha vyavasiyatam, you should be resolved to discover that which you want. If you know it can't be discovered outside, resolve to discover it within. This is Shankaracharya's next instruction. Leading us then to the end of the first verse. So having recognized the defect of worldly life, having committed yourself to seeking the true source of happiness within, then what is the next thing you should do? In Shankara's mind, it's absolutely clear. Nijagrahat turnam vinirgamyatam. Nijagrahat, one's own house or home, turnam immediately, vinirgamyatam, you should come out. You should immediately leave your own home. Now, before I cause a huge problem here, it's necessary to remember that Shankaracharya's students were brahmacharis and sannyasis. That is, they were students already exclusively on a path of spiritual growth, people who had already renounced conventional life. So what Shankara is not saying to our modern students, he is not saying to abandon your responsibilities at any cost, because that won't work. You know that very well. To come out of your home immediately at this point in most of your lives would cause such trauma, such disruption, such hurt. It would be an act of such adharma. How could you possibly base a spiritual life upon an act of adharma by running away from your responsibilities? So that cannot be what Sri Shankara means. He was, of course, speaking to students who didn't have these family responsibilities, so the literal meaning was meant for his students. He meant it. You know, why are you bothering? Why hang around with a home and family when you know it's not going to be a source of contentment and peace? Get out of your home, live as a sannyasi, commit yourself exclusively to a life of spiritual growth. That was indeed his message for his students. Now, for many other students, we have to take another look at the word nijagriha, one's own home. Home is a place where you feel comfortable. Home is a place where you seek comfort. It's a nice definition. Home is a place where we generally seek comfort. How much comfort will you find there? Some. But it varies a lot. It varies depending on what's going on at home, for example. Most of the time, though, it's a place of contentment. The problem, of course, is we all have a tendency to become complacent. There's such a thing as being too comfortable. If you're too comfortable, you become complacent. So when you're sitting there in your comfortable chair, sipping your tea, watching your giant screen television, nijagrahat purnam vinirgamyatam. What for? Atmecha vyavasiyatam. What for? Why should I seek happiness within when my life is so comfortable as it is? So you see that it has a very important message for all of you. And it doesn't mean to abandon your homes and responsibilities, but it's a warning that if you become too complacent in your home, if you use your home and your life and your situation for the sake of finding that contentment, and you become complacent, you will not make progress in your sadhana. You will be stuck at that step. So the warning then Sri Shankara gives us is don't get stuck there. If you are in a home, don't be complacent. Don't get lulled into the naive notion that you can find lasting contentment and peace at home. Let's proceed to the next verse. Sangha satsu vidhiyatam, sangha satsu vidhi. Bhagavato bhaktir dhadhiyatam, bhagavato bhaktir dhadhiyatam, shantyarif parichiyatam, shantyarif parichi, dridataram karma shusantyajyatam, dridataram karma shusantyajyatam, sadvidvanupasripyatam, sadvidvanupasripyatam, pratididam tat paduka sevyatam, pratididam tat paduka sevyatam, brahmaikaksharamartyatam, brahmaikaksharamartyatam, shruti shiro vakyam samakarnyatam, shruti shiro vakyam samakarnyatam. So, having come out of your house, as Sri Shankara's students would have, or rejecting the complacency of living in your home, what is the next step? And it's so significant what Shankara identifies as the next step. It's almost counterintuitive until you think about it. So the next step on his ladder, on his sopana, his next step is sangaha satsu vidhiyatam. Vidhiyatam, may there be sangaha, association, satsu, with good people. Sadhu sangha, satsanga. May there be satsanga, association with good people. Why would Sri Shankaracharya put that at this very crucial step? And Sri Shankara is brilliant in his understanding of human nature. One thing that is absolutely true is what affects us more than anything else in life. These are powerful words, but it's true. What affects us more than anything else in life is the people we associate with. Absolutely true. the people we associate with affect us more than almost anything else. And they can affect us in a positive way, and sadly, they can affect us in a negative way. Satsanga is good. Dussanga is not so good. And you know what it's like to be with the wrong kind of people. Examples. If you're with people who are, pardon me for being a little sarcastic, people who are always partying and always wanting to have fun, if you spend a lot of time with such people, it rubs off on you. Or if you spend time with people who are very materialistic, getting more and more and more and more, workaholic, acquiring bigger and better cars and homes and all of this, if you associate a lot with those people, it rubs off. This is a fact of life. We have been formed, our personalities have been formed, our values have been formed by the people with whom we associate. Fortunately, most of those people have been good people, starting with your parents, with our families. That's our first association with our immediate families. And of course, that continues and as years go by. So who shall we associate with today? The message here is, whoever you associate with, be ready to pick up their values, their qualities, or the opposite, their problems or defects. So Sri Shankaracharya says at this crucial point in this stairway of sadhana, he says, Sangaha satsu vidhiyatam, you must associate with good people. And then he proceeds to show the benefit of satsanga, sadhu sangha. What are the benefits? Bhagavataha bhaktihi dridha adhiyatam. Again, I'm breaking up the words for you. Through satsanga, adhiyatam, one gains, may it be gained. May what be gained? Bhagavataha bhaktihi. Bhakti, devotion. Bhagavataha means for Bhagavan. Devotion to God. Devotion to God, dridha bhakti, very firm devotion to God, is acquired how? Through satsang. This is something that you all take for granted. Most of you grew up in fairly pious households where there was a mother or grandmother or some family member who was always engaged in prayer, in puja, in other religious activities. Isn't it interesting? Those of you who grew up in a home, and I've heard this story many times. Mom is in the puja room. Kids are anywhere else. The only time they'll enter into the puja room is at the end just to get some prasad. Other than that, they won't go in the puja room. But then, just knowing that mom was there in the puja room, just hearing her chant, hearing that ghanti, the bell, hearing the puja going on, those of you who grew up in that kind of household, it affected you in a very wonderful way. I've also heard that those of you who were not blessed to grow up in that kind of household, then you find that your attitudes towards worship and devotion are somewhat different. Well, I grew up in such a household. There was no puja in my home when I was growing up. So then how is it that I've come to have dridha bhakti? As unlikely as it may seem, it's come in my mind and heart very slowly over a period of years. How did it come about? Sangaha satsu vidhiyatam. I'll just share with you a quick anecdote. I remember my first visit to India in 1986, standing next to my guru, Pujaswami Dayananda, before the deity in several temples in different parts of the country, standing there with him. And being the guru that he is, he would not only pray, but he would explain to me all the details of the deity, of the puja, of the temple. So it was a combination of upadesha, teaching, along with that bhakti, that was absolutely crucial for me in developing a heart capable of worship of Lord, capable of bhakti, devotion, dridha bhakti. So, sangha satsu vidhiyatam, sadhu sangha, satsanga is essential for gaining bhakti. Again, those of you who were raised in a religious household, you are blessed. You're fortunate. You have your parents and grandparents to thank for that. But for those of us who were not blessed to grow up in that kind of household, we have to work harder. And the key is sadhu sangha, satsanga. In that way, bhagavata bhaktihi dridha adhiyatam. One can gain intense bhakti through association with other bhaktas. Makes sense. So one benefit of sadhu sangha, satsanga, is deepening one's bhakti, one's devotion. The second benefit, shanti adihi parichiyatam. Parichiyatam, may it be collected. There should be an accumulation of what? Of shanti adi, of values like inner peace, adi, etc. So values that are helpful in spiritual life, values like tolerance, values like patience, values like generosity, values of compassion, all of these values help us along the way in our lives of spiritual growth. How does one acquire values? How do we require any? There's only the main way that we acquired values, the main way you acquired your values is from your parents. That was satsang for you at a young age. Your parents were definitely satjana, good people. Therefore, living with them was satjana sangha, satsanga. It was a blessing to you. So through your association with your parents, you acquire values. Through our association with other good and saintly people, so-called spiritual people, we have an opportunity to acquire many more such values. Values of being, of having inner peace, values of self-control and discipline, values that contribute to a life of spiritual growth. How are these values acquired? Parichiyatam, they're acquired through satsanga. And the third and final thing, the third and final benefit of satsanga is in the end of the first half of the second verse. Dridhataram karma ashu santyajyatam. Santyajyatam. It should be given up completely. What should be given up completely? And dridhataram, really making it very absolute, firmly and completely. Give up what? Karma. And karma here specifically, kamya karma. Give up any efforts to gain happiness through worldly pursuits. That's what it says. And very rightly so. Any effort you make at finding happiness through worldly pursuits, that effort is taking you in the wrong direction, is it not? If you really know that the true source of happiness is within, to the extent that you're still engaged in seeking happiness outside, to that extent you're going in the wrong direction. It does not say you should withdraw from all worldly activities. That's not the message. Many worldly activities are done not for the sake of kamya karma, but for the sake of dharma. You have responsibilities. So doing a karma to satisfy dharma is not kamya. Should I say that again? Any karma for the sake of fulfilling dharma is not kamya. Nitya, naimittika, prayaschitta, but it's not kamya. So therefore, any kamya karma, santyajyatam, should be given up completely, dhritaram, firmly, and ashu, right now, without any delay. This describes another value or virtue that we would commonly call vairagya. Vairagya, dispassion. How does one acquire this value for vairagya? Well, we discussed before, part of it is through this understanding that the true source of happiness isn't out there, the true source of happiness is within. That understanding helps. There's one more thing that helps. What is that? Satsanga. How does satsanga help? And this is almost too obvious. When you see, and I had this opportunity many times traveling in India, you see a simple sadhu, a guy walking along the road, wearing robes like this, but really faded and tattered, and he's got his little satchel, his little bag, and you can tell the guy hasn't been eating well and is living a pretty basic life, looking to find some place to sleep every night, looking for some food. Sadhu, living a very ascetic lifestyle. And I recall seeing some of these people and just seeing a kind of contentment in their eyes, a peace in their attitude and behavior. Makes you wonder, how can they be so content when they don't even have a guarantee of a place to sleep tonight? They don't have a guarantee of food to eat tonight, and yet they're absolutely content. Well, do you think associating with such a person would help you develop vairagya? If that person can be happy and content without guarantees of worldly comfort, then the message is to all of us, anyone can enjoy happiness, contentment, and peace without depending on worldly comfort. And by association with such people, that value of vairagya can be assimilated. So, through sadhu sangha, through satsanga, one can then gain more bhakti, one can gain values like peacefulness, and one can gain vairagya, dispassion. The second half of the verse. So, satsanga gets you ready. Ready for what? So these are all steps. So different levels of preparation. First levels of preparation, perhaps living a prayerful life. Next general level of preparation was gaining the right attitudes, gaining some good values, and gaining a proper perspective that the true source of happiness isn't in the world, but instead is within. So the next step was associating with good people and assimilating their values and qualities. Then the next level, the next step in this sopana, in this ladder, in this stairway, the next step is sadvidwan upasrupyatam. Upasrupyatam, you should approach, you should follow. You should follow who? Sadvidwan. Vidwan is a knowledgeable person, but people can be knowledgeable about all kinds of things. Sadvidwan, a person who is knowledgeable about sat, satyam, truth. Spiritual truth. Sadvidwan is a word for guru, a proper guru. And again, guru can mean different things as well. So vidwan is distinguished here as satvidwan. Guru is also distinguished as satguru, a proper guru, a guru who is capable of leading you to discover that truth. Without a guru, I can't believe that people, actually I can believe, sorry, I shouldn't put it like that. I find it interesting how many people ask this question. Swamiji, is it really necessary to have a guru? And my answer is always the same, no. It's only necessary to have a guru if you want to make ample progress in the spiritual life. But if you don't care about making progress in the spiritual life, you don't need a guru. I mean, how to answer? Is it, Swamiji, is it necessary to have someone who's a good cook? How's that? To have a spouse who's a good cook. Let's rephrase it. Is it necessary to have a spouse who's a good cook? The answer, obviously, is no. Of course not. Unless you enjoy eating nice food. If you enjoy and want to eat nice food, then perhaps having a spouse who is a good cook would be useful. In the same way, if you don't really care about spiritual growth, is a guru necessary? No, absolutely not. But if you are serious about making progress in spiritual life, a guru is indispensable. In fact, to use an American expression, it's a no-brainer. Why? I've given this example before. Suppose you needed to learn calculus. Don't ask me why you would need to learn calculus, but suppose. Suppose you were in a situation where you were desperate and you needed to learn calculus. So to learn calculus, you can go to the library, get all the books on calculus, sit down and start studying. You can learn calculus. Wouldn't it be easier to find someone to teach you? Just common sense? Why tough it out on your own when there are good teachers available? The same principle applies in spiritual life. Is it possible to make progress in spiritual life without a guru? Absolutely. But the progress you'll make is just like the progress you'll make with that stack of calculus books. You'll work really hard at it. You'll misunderstand 90% of what you read. But by making mistakes and going back over that chapter 20 or 30 times, you might eventually figure out where you went wrong and master that chapter, and you're ready for the 230 chapters that follow. This is studying on your own. Yes, you can make progress like that. It's just the most impractical thing in the world. In the same way, if you're really serious and intent about making progress in spiritual life, to proceed without the help of a good guru is just to use a simple word, it's impractical. Yes, you can do it, but why do things the hard way? Someone said, someone showed me that there's a nice expression some people use in India. There's a simple way to do things, there's a hard way to do things. Simple way is getting a guru. The hard way is on your own. And the example they give is just like touching your nose. There's a simple way to touch your nose. There's a hard way to touch your nose. You can choose. Choice is up to you. All right. Sadvidwan upasripyatam. Approach a proper guru. How should you approach a proper guru? There's some rules here. Yeah, here's a good rule. Rikta hastena na upayat rajanam daivatam gurum. Rikta hastena, with empty hands, na upayat, one should not approach. One should not approach empty-handed. Who should you not approach empty-handed? Rajanam, a king. It's true, you know, if you want a politician to help you, empty hands don't work. So rajanam, don't approach empty-handed. Daivatam, in prayer and worship, there's always something given, some naivedyam, some offering is always given during prayer and worship. So rajanam, daivatam, and gurum. These three should not be approached empty-handed. A king, deity for the sake of worship, or guru. So for that reason, for that reason, pratidinam tat paduka sevyatam. For that reason, tat paduka, his feet, his sandals, literally, the guru's feet, the guru's feet, the guru's sandals, sevyatam, should be served pratidinam every day. Service should be offered at the guru's feet every day. You're approaching the guru every day, or every week, or every month, whatever is the situation. Every time you come, you shouldn't come empty-handed. And the reason for that is just a very practical one. The guru is one who's already nijagrahat vinirgamyatam. The guru has already come out of his home, so to speak. He's already given up any means of taking care of one's own needs. So therefore, the guru becomes dependent on the generosity of others. And without the generosity of others, the guru can't teach. Very practical, isn't it? Without the generosity of others, the guru cannot teach. This applied in the time of the ancient Gurukulams, where students would go and live with their teachers in ancient India. It applies equally today. Gurus in ashrams, there's a necessity for support, financial support, and otherwise, just for the very practical reason. Otherwise, the teaching cannot go on. So therefore, pratidinam, every day. Every day means as required. Tat paduka sevitam. Some form of service is to be offered at the guru's feet. Now, some people could really get off on a wrong step here. Tat paduka sevitam. Oh, let me resort to my guru's feet. Let me sit at my guru's feet and just offer my devotion, my prayer, my worship. I'm going to be the greatest guru bhakta. I'm going to be so devoted to my guru. There's nothing wrong with being devoted to a guru, but the guru's blessings are primarily in the form of upadesha, spiritual teaching. For a bhakta will be blessed by whomever they worship. If they sit at an altar, the bhakta will be blessed. If the bhakta sits at guru's feet, the bhakta will similarly be blessed. But the guru has the rare capacity to give the person so much more. But the person has to ask. Sometimes, I share with you another anecdote. When I was a young student living with Pooja Swami Dayananda in his ashram in Salisbury, this is in the 1980s, we students categorized visitors to the ashram. Visitors included many of you. Some of you came out there in the 1980s, and perhaps more recently, I hope. We students were always observing. By the way, we students were mostly American, not all. And so here we have American spiritual students observing the visitors to the ashram who were almost entirely Indian. And we students, rightly or wrongly, we categorized all the visitors in two categories. There were students and there were devotees. That's the way it looked to us students. That is, of the visitors who came to Arsha Vidya Gurukulam, this is way back in the 1980s, we students observed that many came to learn from Pooja Swami Dayananda, who happens to be, at least in my opinion, the greatest living teacher of Advaita Vedanta. You can't do better. So many visitors came. But we observed that a few of the visitors either didn't attend class, or if they did go to class, they would sleep. But then, whenever they could, you'd see the ones who were sleeping in the back of the class would be sitting on top of Pooja Swamiji's feet during satsang. So we students categorize such visitors as devotees. They were devoted to Pooja Swamiji as a figure of worship. There's nothing wrong with that. but they're missing out on what was truly special that he had to give. I saw that in another situation when I was in Chennai with Pujya Swamiji. He was giving a series of lectures in this huge lecture hall. And in each lecture, I noticed in the very back of the hall were several rows of old ladies, old Tamilian ammas that didn't know a word of English. The lectures were all in English. They didn't know any English. They came every day. They sat there through hours and hours of lecture. These are devotees. There's nothing wrong with that, except, sadly, they weren't able to get something of extraordinary value that Pujya Swamiji had to share. So, the message here, pratidinam tat paduka sevitam, one should offer oneself at Guru's feet and certainly offer whatever support is necessary, but merely being a Guru Bhakta is not enough. Because the main blessing of the Guru comes in the form of upadesha, spiritual teachings, and you have to ask for those spiritual teachings. Brahma eka aksharam artyatam. Artyatam, it should be asked for. One should request, one should ask for. One should ask for what? Brahma eka akshara. Eka akshara, one syllable that expresses Brahman, ultimate reality. The one syllable that expresses ultimate reality, brahmaikakshara, is om. That's what it means. Brahma eka akshara, om. Om artyatam. One should request om. What is that? One should request om. What does that mean? The meaning of om, an explanation of om. Artyatam has that sense. One should not just request, but one should request the meaning to understand what is om, who is om, what does om mean. Om happens to be the first word in the Vedas. It is. Om Agnimile Purohitam. Beginning of the Rig Veda is om. The idea is you're asking here for an explanation. This is then interpreted as to ask to be taught the scriptures. That's what the implied meaning of that statement is. Brahmaikaksharam artyatam. One should request the meaning of om, but in a broader sense, one should request to be taught the scriptures. And the next, scriptures means what now? We said that a lot of the Vedas are concerned with kamya karmas. So if we're going to ask to be taught the scriptures, what part of the scriptures? Shruti shiras vakyam samakaranyatam. Samakaranyatam, you should listen to. May it be listened to. May you listen to what? Vakyam, statements. Statements from the scripture, from what part of the scripture? Shruti shiras. Shruti means scripture. It means Vedas, really speaking. Shruti means that which is heard, and in a technical way is used to refer to the four Vedas. But the bulk of the Vedas deals with ritual, and a lot of it kamya karma. So therefore, what part of the Shruti should you ask to be taught? He's very specific. You should be asked, you should want to listen to samakaranyatam, you should listen to vakyam, teachings or statements which are from the Shruti Shiras, from the head of the Shruti. The Shruti has a head? Well, just to help you out here, just to show how this stuff is understood. Shrutehi Shiraha Antadeshaha. It's the extreme portion of a person's body, the topmost part of your body is your head, and the topmost part is Parayavasana Deshaha, the culminating part. The topmost part, Shruti Shiras, Shiras head, Parayavasana Desha, the culminating part. What is the culminating part of the Shruti, of the Vedas? Most of you know that the Vedas are compiled with four sections. The first section, Samhita, they have all the prayers, all the hymns of praise. The second section of the four of each of the four Vedas is Brahmana, which is mostly instructions for rituals. The third section, called Aranyaka, were meditations meant to go along with those rituals, or meditations to be done in a forest. But the final part, the culminating part, Parayavasana Desha, the culminating part of each of the four Vedas is found at the end of the Vedas, Anta of the Vedas, Veda Anta Vedanta. Technically, they're called Upanishad. So first part, Samhita, are the hymns of praise. Second part, Brahmana, are the ritual instructions. Third part, Aranyaka, are the meditations. Fourth part, Upanishad, also called Vedanta. This is Shruti Shiras, because it's in those Upanishads where the ancient rishis unfolded absolute truths, truths and teachings which can lead you to discover the fact that the truth of you is the truth of all. This is the ultimate truth expressed in the Mahavakya Tattvamasi. This is what's going to be discussed in the very next verse, so we'll save that for the next class. So the focus then, you approach a guru not to ask about performance of various rituals. You approach a guru and you offer whatever kind of service is necessary for the sake of, and you have to ask to be taught. Brahmaikaksharam artyatam. You have to ask to be taught, but to be taught what? Shruti Shiras Vakyam Samakaranyatam. For you to have an opportunity to listen to the teachings of the Upanishads being properly unfolded. So this is the conclusion of the second verse. We'll continue, we'll go fairly, it's, you know, just five verses, so we may finish next time or the time after that. We'll continue in our next class. Just to remind you then, in our next class, note that the doors will be closed after a few minutes grace time after 7:30, so please come on time for the meditation. Also, please go to our website and print out a copy of the text or purchase a copy from any source. It'll help you stay focused on our studies here. And I'll look forward to seeing you next class. We'll conclude with our brief prayers.